So we're about to start chapter one. And really, like, you know, remember we're in this yechidus with the Alter Rebbe, and we have questions like, what's life about? What's my journey here? The Alter Rebbe starts Tanya with a statement from the Talmud that tells us about an oath that we took before we were born. And that's kind of like our mission statement, right? Like, before we came down here, we took an oath. And that tells us a lot about who we are, what our job is, what we're meant to accomplish, and also what are the goalposts. And the Alter Rebbe is going to take terms that we thought we knew and open up our horizons. We're going to start questioning things that we just kind of took for granted and realize that the way we always understood them, it just can't be the way to define them. Like, for example, the term Beinoni. In fact, the book of Tanya is called Tanya because that's the first word of the Tanya. But the Alter Rebbe didn't call it the Tanya. He called it Sefer Shel Beinonim, the book of the Beinonim. So what is a Beinoni? That's going to be very hard to understand because it's not the way we classically understand it. Perek Aleph, chapter 1. Tanya, we have learned, besides Perek Gimel Denida, Mashbiyim Eisai. Nida, the end of chapter 3, an oath is administered to him. Before he was born, an oath is administered to him in heaven, charging him. Tehi tzadik va'al tehi rasha, va'afilu kol ha'aylam kulay, aymrim locha tzadik ata, heyei be'einecha kirasha. Be righteous and don't be wicked. And even if the whole world, judging you by your actions, tells you that you are righteous, regard yourself as wicked. Okay, so this is the statement, right? The mission statement. Right before we come down here, it is taught in a Baraisa, Tanya. Tanya means it's taught in a Baraisa. If you look in the Talmud, this is a statement from Rabbi Simlai. And over there, the Talmud says, Darash Rabbi Simlai. Rabbi Simlai taught. And here, the Alter Rebbe uses the word Tanya. It is taught in a Baraisa. A Baraisa is a work from the time of the Mishnah, which is pre-Talmud, pre-Gemara. Rabbi Simlai lived in a bridge generation, and so sometimes he's quoted with Tanaim, sometimes he's quoted with Amoraim, and here the Alter Rebbe is employing the term Tanya. So the Tzemach Tzedek, the grandson of the Alter Rebbe, speaks about the way that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai started the Idra Rabba of the Zohar. There's a section of the Zohar called Idra Rabba, and the first word of the Idra Rabba is Tanya. It also starts with Tanya. And the Arizal, the great Kabbalist, explains why did Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai start the Idra Rabba with the word Tanya? And he said that there is a klipa, a negative spiritual force that's called Tanya, and it wedges itself into the heart of the Torah student, trying to deter him from studying the inner aspect of the Torah. And it says to the Torah student, make do with the simple explanation. Who do you think you are to study the deeper aspect of the Torah? And that's why Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai started the Idra Rabba with the word Tanya, to counteract the klipa. Because the way we do away with it is by studying the deeper aspect of the Torah. And in fact, this klipa is hinted to when Moshe Rabbeinu tells the tribes that we're going to take their portion on that side of the Jordan River. He says, V'lama sini'un eslev b'nei Yisrael. Why would you deter the heart of the Jewish people? Tini'un is Tanya. This is the klipa that tries to deter us from studying the inner aspect of the Torah. And that's why the Alter Rebbe too started the Tanya with the word Tanya, to counteract that klipa that tries to deter us from studying the secrets of the Torah. And so it's no wonder that Tanya got to be known as Tanya, because that's not what the Alter Rebbe called it. He called it Sefer Shel Beinonim. But obviously, Tanya is so powerful because it counteracts that klipa that tries to deter us from studying the deeper aspect of the Torah. So we're looking at this oath, okay? This is really our mission statement. We're about to be sent down to this world. And this is what we are made to swear. Be a tzaddik. Don't be a rasha. And even if everybody looks at you and sees like, oh my gosh, this is a righteous person, everything he does is righteous, you in your own eyes have to consider yourself like a rasha. Now, we're going to be very baffled by this statement. And the Alter Rebbe is going to focus mainly in this section on the last part of the oath, that even if the whole world tells you you're righteous, you should consider yourself wicked. He's going to question that. The other parts, be a tzaddik, don't be a rasha, that's he's going to address in chapter 14. So the soul of a Jew descends into a body for a purpose, in order to fulfill a specific spiritual mission in this world. To enable him to fulfill it, a heavenly oath is administered to him that he be righteous and not wicked, and concurrently that he regard himself as wicked and not righteous. The root, shava, of the verb mashbi'im, an oath is administered, is virtually identical with the root, sava, of the verb masbi'im, one causes him to be sated, to become full, to become satiated. Accordingly, the oath charging him to be righteous may also be understood to mean that the soul is thereby invested, sated, with the power that enables it to fulfill its destiny in life on earth. So why would you take an oath? You already know what you have to do. Why are you taking an oath? Be righteous, don't be wicked. What does an oath help? And in general in life, why do people swear to each other? When someone takes an oath, it gives them a special fortitude. It gives them a special strength. And especially when someone takes an oath in heaven, then the soul is fortified with all the powers that it needs in order to fulfill this oath. So before we came out down here, we took an oath to be righteous and not to be wicked. And the way we're supposed to look at ourselves, though, is that we're like wicked. Now that's very difficult to understand. So the Alter Rebbe right away gets to it. V'tzarech l'havin. This calls for explanation. And you'll notice that in a lot of Hasidic texts, when they ask a question, they'll ask it this way. V'tzarech l'havin. We need to understand. And why is that? Because a lot of times people will say like v'kasha, it's difficult. No, it's not that the text is difficult. It's that we don't understand. The text is perfect, but we're baffled. So the problem is with us. The deficiency is ours. We need to understand. What do we need to understand? Dehatinan aves perak beis va'al tehi rasha b'fnei atzmecha. For we have learned in the Mishnah, in Avos chapter 2, be not wicked in your own estimation. Okay, so over there, the Mishnah says, don't be a rasha in your own eyes. We have this statement that we have to regard ourselves as a rasha, but one second, the Mishnah says, don't think of yourself as a rasha. So there's a contradiction from the Mishnah. And then besides the contradiction from the Mishnah, there's going to be a logical contradiction. Just as a human being, think about it for a minute. Does it make sense to call yourself wicked? The Alter Rebbe will say why it doesn't make sense to walk around thinking, I'm wicked, I'm wicked, I'm wicked. How then can we say that an oath is administered to the soul that it regard itself as wicked when this directly contradicts the Mishnaic injunction not to regard oneself as wicked? V'gam, im hiya b'ein of kirasha, yera levavai v'hiya atzef. Furthermore, if a person considers himself wicked, he will be grieved at heart and depressed. V'la yuchal la'avai Hashem b'simcha v'tuv levav. And consequently, will not be able to serve God joyfully and with a contented heart. Apart from the previously mentioned contradiction from the Mishnah, an additional question is now raised. A cardinal principle in the service of Hashem is that it be performed with joy. Joy at the privilege of serving Him, either through performing a positive mitzvah or by refraining from that which is prohibited. How then can we be required to take an oath to consider ourselves wicked when it's going to cause us to be depressed, making it impossible to serve Hashem with joy? Furthermore, just as the first part of the oath, be righteous and don't be wicked, is vital to our success in realizing our life's mission, so too the fulfillment of the second part of the oath, that we consider ourselves wicked, is imperative. How can it possibly be so when such an attitude hinders joyful service of Hashem? It's a cardinal principle in Yiddishkeit, we have to serve Hashem with joy. That's what David HaMelech writes in Tehillim. Ivdu es Hashem besimcha, serve Hashem with joy. And the Torah, in giving all these warnings, what's going to happen if, God forbid, we don't fulfill Hashem's commands, gives all those curses, and then says, Tachas asher le'avadata es Hashem eleikecha besimcha v'tuv levav. All this will befall them because they did not serve Hashem with joy and gladness of heart. And the Rambam speaks about that in Hilchas Lulav and says it is so important to serve Hashem with joy. And anybody who stops himself from experiencing the joy of serving Hashem is a fool and sinful. It's so important to serve Hashem with joy. And the Arizal speaks about this because you didn't serve Hashem with joy. And he says, even if the Jews were, God forbid, sinning, but when they were doing mitzvahs, they were serving Hashem joyfully, Hashem would have forgiven their sins. The lack of the joy is what was the clincher was. That's what the punishment came for. The punishment came for not so much their sins, but for not serving Hashem with joy. So If we're going to walk around thinking that we're a Russia, then we're not going to feel good. And if we don't feel good, we can't serve Hashem with joy. We have to serve Hashem with joy. Well, if his heart will not at all be grieved by this self-appraisal, meaning if we should propose that in order to fulfill the oath, the person will indeed regard himself as wicked, but at the same time, he will resolve that his wickedness shall not perturb him so as not to encumber his joyful service of Hashem. He's going to say, you know what? I really have to be happy when I serve Hashem. Okay, so I'm not going to take it seriously. I'm just going to put it aside and say, it's fine, so I'm wicked. Well, then what's going to happen? If a person walks around saying, I'm wicked and it's not a big deal, he may be led to irreverence, God forbid, by such an attitude, with sin perturbing him not at all. For although his original resolve that being wicked will not perturb him stems only from his sincere desire to serve Hashem with joy, yet such a resolution may very well lead to a situation where wickedness will truly not disturb him. If nothing that you do is going to help, you try and you try and you try, but ultimately, it doesn't say only once you are totally righteous are you allowed to consider yourself righteous. That's not what it says. It says you should be righteous. Don't be wicked, but no matter what you do, no matter how much you progress, always consider yourself wicked. Isn't that hopeless? Like nothing I'm going to do is ever going to help. I'm just always going to be wicked. So either I'm going to feel really bad about it or going to say, you know what, I don't care. The second you don't care, that's when it's very dangerous. Then it's like, okay, I'm a Russia anyway, big deal. The Talmud says that somebody who sins and then sins again, now it becomes like permitted to him. You know, the first time somebody does something wrong was like, they're like a little bit shocked themselves. And the next time it's like, eh, it's not so bad. Before you know it, it's a mitzvah. They just don't care. You know, you're sitting at the table, you're passing something, and then suddenly a little ketchup on your sleeve. Okay. And the next person is passing, oops, a little bit of mustard on your next sleeve. Okay. By the time they serve the challenge, you're like, okay. Chelling on me. It's just, you know, like, that's it. It's hopeless. If you feel like nothing that you're going to do is going to help you progress, you're really stuck. There's a story of the Alter Rebbe that he went to collect money in order to redeem captives. And he came to a certain town that was known for some wealthy people. And he asked the dignitaries of the Jewish community to take him around so he can go collecting. And as they started walking, there was a huge mansion with a mezuzah. And they just walked past. And he said, no, I want to go to that house. He said, no, you don't want to go to that house. That house is the house of a miser. You'll come in, he'll sit there, he'll listen, you'll tell him the whole story. After your whole speech, he's going to give you 5 kopecks. And he said, I want to go to that house. So they bring him to that house. And he sits down, and he tells the whole story. The man is very respectful. He listens to the plight, captives. And then he takes out 5 kopecks and he says, here. And remember, they need like 5,000 rubles. And the Alter Rebbe says, thank you so much. May you merit to do many more mitzvahs. And he gets up to leave. And then the man said, no. I want to give you more. So he comes back and he gives the Alter Rebbe a ruble, like a dollar. Okay, the Alter Rebbe thanks him sincerely. Such a beautiful mitzvah. He called him back twice, 3 times, 4 times. By the time the Alter Rebbe left the house, he left with the entire sum of money. And what was it? Because originally, when he was being a little stingy or very stingy, the people would throw the 5 kopecks back in his face. And he thought, you know what? Nobody appreciates me. Anything I do isn't going to help. But when the Alter Rebbe took his 5 kopecks and he said, thank you, all of a sudden he realized that I could make a difference. Something that I do is going to help. But if nothing I'm going to do is ever going to help, then I'm really in a bad place. We have 2 choices. If a person has to consider themselves wicked, okay, so either they're going to be depressed, and that's really not good. They won't be able to serve Hashem with joy, and we must serve Hashem with joy. And to say, you know, I won't let it get to me. Okay, well, then you're just going to be spiritually negligent, and that's very dangerous too. So we're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. Ach ha'inyan. However, the above matter will be more clearly understood after a preliminary discussion of the true meaning of righteous and wicked. And again, here's a phrase that's used in Chassidus, like ach ha'inyan or ach be'er ha'inyan. Like the idea is, it's the point here is not just to resolve questions with answers. No, the point is to open up our vistas, turn on the light, and once we start to explore, then the question organically falls away. So that's what we're doing now. We're going to explore these terms that we think we know. We think we know what a tzaddik is. We think we know what a rasha is. We think we know what a beinoni is. Let's look at it. So, kihine matzino bagamara he chalukais, tzaddik v'tayvlei, tzaddik v'ralei. We find in the Gemara 5 distinct types. A righteous man who prospers materially as well as spiritually. He knows only good. A righteous man who suffers in both a material as well as spiritual sense. Spiritually, he has not yet vanquished all his evil, and in the material sense, too, he's wanting. Rush of a Taivlai, Rush of a Ralai, Uvainani. A wicked man in whom there is some good and who prospers. A wicked man who suffers spiritually and materially. And an intermediate man, the Benoni. So Altarba says, we find in the Gemara, if you flip through the Gemara, you'll find five different categories among the Jewish people. If we're going to divide everybody spiritually, we're going to divide them in five. There's the righteous man who prospers, the righteous man who suffers, the wicked man who prospers, the wicked man who suffers, and the Benoni. These five types. If we come to understand what these five types are, we're going to get more clarity about all of this and this oath that we have to take and our mission in life. Opershuba Gemara, so now that the Gemara explains, what does it mean, a righteous man who prospers? Tzadik v'tayvlei, tzadik gamor. The righteous man who prospers is the consummate, meaning complete tzadik. Once he has achieved this level, physical suffering to cleanse his soul from the impurities of sin is unnecessary. He therefore prospers materially as well. So when we say that he is a righteous man who prospers, it's an outcome of a spiritual state of things. Why does he prosper? Because he has no evil in him whatsoever. He is so righteous that he doesn't have to be cleansed of any sins. The Maharsha, who is a commentator on the Talmud, explains that a righteous man who suffers is somebody who Hashem gives him suffering in this world so that when he gets to the next world, he doesn't have to suffer at all because he's righteous. He has very little evil to him. And instead of having to suffer much more in the next world, Hashem gives him suffering in this world. So they're not two different categories. It's not the tzaddik gamor and the tzaddik v'tayvlei. No, it's the same thing. The complete tzaddik is the tzaddik who prospers. And the reason why he prospers is because his righteousness is complete. Tzaddik v'ralei, tzaddik she'enei gamor. The righteous man who suffers is the imperfect, literally the incomplete tzaddik. He therefore experiences some measure of material suffering, thereby cleansing the soul while it is yet clothed in the body, so that he will not have to endure any spiritual suffering in the world to come. Accordingly, the Gemara is not referring to two tzaddikim on the same spiritual level. One of them suffers and the other one prospers. Rather, the Gemara is speaking about two distinct levels of tzaddikim. The Gemara thus cites only two characterizations regarding the tzaddik. Gamor and Einei Gamor. Consummate and imperfect, which means literally complete and incomplete. The terms who prospers or who suffers don't indicate his spiritual level. They're merely describe his resultant material status. So now we are trying to get a picture of the playing field, and we find out that there's five categories among the Jewish people. There is a perfect tzaddik and an imperfect tzaddik, a Rasha who is not so wicked, and a Rasha who is completely wicked, and a Benoni. And yes, we were also talking about their material state, that there's a tzaddik who prospers and a tzaddik who suffers, a wicked man who prospers and a wicked man who suffers. Those material states reflect their spiritual state. So we first got the interpretation of the Talmud. What does it mean, tzaddik v'tayvlei? That he is a perfect tzaddik. Okay, so the Talmud interprets tzaddik v'tayvlei, he's a perfect tzaddik. Now let's look at the Zohar. What does the Zohar say? Uvaraya mehemna parshas mishpatim, peirash tzadik v'ralei sheharash abay kafaflatay v'chulei. In Raya mehemna parshas mishpatim, it is explained that the righteous man who suffers is one whose evil nature is subservient to his good nature. So we're looking at it from a spiritual state of things. We're taking it beyond its literal interpretation that he is a righteous man who suffers, and instead we're reading it differently. We're saying tzadik, he is a righteous man, v'ra lai. And evil, his own evil nature, belongs to him. He is a tzaddik who still retains some vestige of evil, albeit subservient to his good nature. Accordingly, a righteous man who prospers is a tzaddik in whom there is only good, since he has totally transformed his evil nature. According to the Zohar, of which Raya Mehemna is a part, actually Raya Mehemna means the faithful shepherd. This is the part of the Zohar that's attributed to Moshe Rabbeinu. So in this part of the Zohar, it explains the terms who prospers and who suffers, that they also indicate and describe the level of the tzaddik. The tzaddik who prospers is a tzaddik in whom there is only good. The evil within it having already been transformed to good. The tzaddik who suffers is a tzaddik of a lower stature, one who still harbors some evil. However, we must now understand why redundant titles are given to each level of tzaddik. It's the same tzaddik, so we're calling him complete tzaddik and also tzaddik v'tayvle, tzaddik who prospers. And we're saying an incomplete tzaddik, and we're calling the same kind of tzaddik a tzaddik virale, tzaddik who suffers. If the complete tzaddik is the tzaddik who prospers, meaning in whom there's only good, and the incomplete tzaddik is the tzaddik who suffers, meaning he retains a vestige of evil, why then is it necessary to give each tzaddik two appellations? The explanation provided further on in chapter 10 is that each descriptive term denotes a specific aspect of divine service of the tzaddik. The terms complete tzaddik and incomplete tzaddik denote the level of the service of the tzaddik's godly soul, meaning the tzaddik's love of Hashem. For it is by virtue of this love that he's called tzaddik. The complete tzaddik is the one who attained perfection in his love of Hashem in a matter of ahava betanugim, love of delights, the serene love of fulfillment. The tzaddik whose ahava betanugim is as yet imperfect is called the incomplete or unperfected tzaddik. So when we're talking about complete or incomplete, we're looking at the positive aspect of them. How in love are they with Hashem? The complete tzaddik is his reached a level of complete and total love of ahava betanugim. The incomplete tzaddik, he hasn't quite reached that same level of love. That's one aspect of him when we describe when we say tzaddik gamor, tzaddik she'eno gamor. So then what about tzaddik v'tovlo, tzaddik v'ralo? The term tzaddik who prospers, that's a tzaddik v'tovlo, and tzaddik who suffers, tzaddik v'ralo, denote that tzaddik's status vis-a-vis his efforts in transforming his animal soul to holiness. For the tzaddik, through his lofty service of ahava b'ta'anugim, transforms the evil within him into holiness and good. The designation of tzaddik who prospers indicates that he has totally transformed the evil within him, and now good alone remains, while the tzaddik who suffers is one who has not managed to totally transform the evil within him to good. A vestige of it still remains. So it's totally not about behavior. Neither the tzaddik v'tayvle nor the tzaddik v'rale has any sins at all. This is a much deeper definition. It's, do they harbor any evil? A tzaddik v'tayvle, he manages to take the evil within him and actually transform it to a force for good. The animal soul has a very different nature than the godly soul. The godly soul is serene. The animal soul, you know how it is feisty. When we transform that feisty animal to be a force for good, it's an extra measure of goodness. And that is the tzaddik v'tayvle. He was able to transform that part of himself that used to be evil and make it into a force for good. It's like the story of Reb Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev, where the first night of Sukkot, he couldn't wait till the morning would break so he can finally shake the lulav and esrog because he didn't do it all year. He's literally like staring at the glass all night, and like morning he goes running and crashes his hand through the glass because he couldn't contain himself. He was so excited to grab the lulav and esrog. This is somebody who literally his animal became an animal of goodness.
So I have a question. It seems like a fine line between this level of tzaddik, who hasn't completely got that, and the Beinoni, who can be on a high level. He's not doing anything negative, but he has the struggles. It seems that this incomplete tzaddik still has some of that struggle.
No struggle. His evil doesn't even have a voice. It just exists somewhere within him. It's very different than the Beinoni, where his evil actually has a voice. And we're going to discuss this at length in chapter 10, Be'ezras Hashem. And what's so amazing, or part of the journey of the Tanya, is we're asking like a million questions right here. They're not going to all be resolved in the first chapter. You know, 7 chapter 10, 7 12, 7 13 and 14. We're going to get there. But this is really a journey. This is a journey. We're going to explore these terms. And the tzaddik v'rale is definitely on a much higher level than the Beinoni. He doesn't have that struggle. The explanations that follow make it abundantly clear that the evil referred to here is no more than an amorphous evil, evil still harbored in the heart of the incomplete tzaddik. For the tzaddik has no association with actual evil that manifests itself in thought or speech, and most certainly not with the evil that finds expression in actions. Uva Gemara, Seif Perak Tes de Brachais, Tzaddikim Yetzer Tev Sheiften Chule, Rasha'im Yetzer Hara Sheiften. So we're trying to understand, what is a tzaddik? What is a rasha? What is a beinoni? So we look at the Gemara, and the Gemara said that a tzaddik v'tayvle is a complete tzaddik. A tzaddik, the v'ralo, is an incomplete tzaddik. And then we looked at the Zohar, and we saw that a tzaddik v'ralo is a tzaddik whose evil is subjugated to the good within him. Now we're looking at the Gemara again, and the Gemara says like this. In the Gemara, end of chapter 9 of Brachais, it is stated that the righteous are judged, meaning motivated and ruled by their good nature having the final say. The wicked are judged, meaning motivated and ruled by their evil nature having the final say. Beinanim zeh v'zeh sheiften v'chulei. intermediate men are judged by both the good and evil nature. So we're trying to find what's the middle category. So we say, okay, this is the middle category. Tzaddikim, it's their Yetzer Tov that has it. Their good inclination, that's what has the voice. Reshaim, it's their evil inclination, that's what has the voice. So who is the Beinoni? Both of them have a voice. It's very difficult to understand, because as we're going to go along, we're going to see it's totally not about action. A Beinoni really is perfect in his action. Some things just don't have a middle point. So it's not clearly not the middle point between the tzaddik and the rasha. We're going to go into a very deep dimension to discover who the Beinoni is. Now, when Rabbah was teaching his students, he was trying to give them an illustration of the Beinoni because it seems like such an elusive category. What is the Beinoni? So this is the example he gives them. Amar Rabbah, kigoin ana Beinoni. Rabbah declared, I, for example, am a Beinoni. So let's see who Rabbah is. Rabbah is the head of the yeshiva of Pumpatisa. He is an outstanding leader of the Jewish people. He's teaching his students and he says, you want to know what a Beinoni is? A Beinoni is for me. Me, for example, I am a Beinoni. You want an example? That's the example of the Beinoni. Amar le Abaye, leishavak marchaye lechol beri v'chuli. Said Abaye to him, Master, you make it impossible for any creature to live. Abaye argued thus, if you are a Beinoni, then all those on a lower level than you are in the category of Rasha, wicked, concerning whom our sages say, the wicked, even when they're alive, are considered dead. By calling yourself a Beinoni, you make it impossible for anyone to live. So Abaye is Rabbah's prized student and his nephew, and he hears Rabbah make this statement, you know what a Beinoni is? Me, I, for example, am a Beinoni. And Abaye says, how could you say that? If you call yourself a Beinoni, everybody else is a Rasha, and a Rasha is like dead. You don't let anybody live. You're not letting any of us live. If you're a Beinoni, the standard's up here. How could Rabbah confuse himself as a Beinoni? And again, there's no false humility here. It's he really believes that he is a Beinoni. Now, obviously, he wasn't a Beinoni. He was a tzaddik. But if you're going to make a mistake, it has to be between things that are similar. You know, between dusk and nightfall, you might make a mistake. But between like broad daylight and midnight, you're not going to make a mistake. There's such a clear difference. So if Rabbah is calling himself a Beinoni, there must be something very similar between him, the Beinoni, and the tzaddik. And again, Rabbah's not being falsely humble. I mean, as we'll see, the angel of death did not have power over him. He clearly was not being falsely humble because he said about himself, as we'll visit in the story, he said about himself, "Ani yachid b'negaim, ani yachid ba'ahalais." I am singular in my knowledge of leprosy, tzaraas, and I am singular in my knowledge of ahalais, if somebody is in the tent together with a dead human being. So he's saying, I am the expert in this field. If he can say about himself, I am the expert in his field, it means he's somebody who's not afraid to admit his knowledge, to admit his talents, to know his worth. And yet him, of that high caliber, goes and says, I, for example, am a Beinoni. Ulahavin calls that Bar Hativ. To understand all the aforesaid clearly, an explanation is called for. In addition to the question that will soon follow, that according to the common conception of a Beinoni as a person having half mitzvahs and half transgressions, how could a great sage like Rabbah mistake himself for a Beinoni? A further question is implied. If a Beinoni is simply having half mitzvahs and half transgressions, then his status is readily identifiable. There's no possible room for debate. So we're going to now have to really flesh out these five categories. And once we do, it gives us the bedrock of understanding of our mission in life and what is expected of us. V'gam lahavin masha amar iyaif. Baba Basar Parak Aleph. Rabbi Nishalelem, barasa tzadikim, barasa rishaim chule. And also to understand the statement of Iyof, Job, Baba Basar chapter 1. Lord of the universe, you have created righteous men, you have created wicked men. So the Talmud tells us that Iyof is trying to exonerate the whole world from judgment. He says to Hashem, he's complaining. He said, you made all beings as they are. They didn't choose to be how they are. You made an ox with split hooves. You made a donkey with closed hooves. You created heaven and hell. You made tzaddikim, you made rasha'im. He said, Mi ma'akev al yadcha. Who's going to stop you? You're the master of the world. You created very different beings with very different nature. Everything is predetermined. The way everybody acts, that's the way that you plan that they should act. So he's complaining and he says, Master of the universe, you created tzaddikim, you created rasha'im. V'ha tzadik v'rasha l'ka'amar. But he does not decree which people are to be righteous or wicked. The Talmud tells us that Hashem decrees that a child about to be born will be wise or foolish, strong or weak, and so on. However, whether the child will be righteous or wicked, Hashem does not say. This is not predetermined. Rather, it is left to the individual's free choice. How then are we to understand Job's plaint? You have created righteous men, you have created wicked men. So he's saying, Hashem, it's not fair. You created tzaddikim. He's complaining, you created tzaddikim, you created rishayim. But the Talmud tells us clearly that before a child is born, an angel brings this drop of conception before Hashem. And he says, Master of the universe, is this child going to be foolish? Is he going to be wise? Is he going to be strong? Is he going to be weak? But there's one question that he doesn't ask and Hashem doesn't say. Is he going to be righteous and he's going to be wicked? Because hakol bidei shemayim chutz me'ira shemayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven. That's our choice. You know, that anecdote they tell of the man before you know it, he's dead. And he sees Hashem coming with his suitcase and he said, come on, sonny, time to go. I have your suitcase. And he said, already now? I had so many plans. He said, sorry, time to go. He said, whose suitcase are you carrying? He said, that's yours. He said, what's in there? He's like, it's your things. He said, what are my things? Is it my house, my car? He said, no, those are not yours. He said, is it my family? No, those are not yours. Are they my talents? Those are not yours either. So what's in the suitcase? Sonny, the only thing you own are your own choices. That's your belongings, and that's what I have in your suitcase. So Hashem doesn't declare if we're going to be righteous or wicked. Those are our belongings. And yet, the Talmud says that Iyov said, you created tzaddikim and you created rishayim. He wasn't lying. There's a truth to that statement, that there's such a thing as a born tzaddik and a born rasha, but not really, because of course Hashem doesn't decide how we're going to live our life in a moral way. Okay, so let's just sum up the questions that we have so far. We need to understand, first of all, how is it that even if the whole world tells us that we're righteous, we personally are to consider ourselves as wicked? I mean, we're not supposed to consider ourselves wicked. Second of all, we're trying to flesh out these five categories. Really, what is the difference between like a Beinoni, who we know is on a very high level, therefore Rabba mistook himself for a Beinoni, and a Tzaddik? And then third of all, we need to ask ourselves, how did Iyov say, you created tzaddikim and you created rishayim? I thought that's not predetermined. I thought that's our choice. V'gam lehavin mahus madregas habeinoni. You must also understand the essential nature, the mahus, of the rank of the beinoni. Mahus, you could read it like mahu. What is it? If you're going to typify it, if you're really going to classify it for what it is, how do we define it? The mahus of a tzaddik is righteousness. The mahus of the wicked man is evil. What is the mahus, the essential nature of the Beinoni? And the way they translate it in the Steinsaltz Tanya is the nature of the level of the Beinoni. And Rabbi Steinsaltz posits like this. He says, the nature and the level are two different things, and you can posit and say that all of life is trying to reconcile his nature and his level. The Beinoni is clearly someone who has a lot of internal struggle, as we're going to see. So who is he? What's his mahus? What is his essential nature? Shebevadai, enay mechta zechuyais umechta avaynais. She'im kein, ech ta'araba ba'atzmai laymar shehu beinoni. He is certainly not one whose deeds are half virtuous and half sinful. For if this were so, how could Rabba err in classifying himself as a beinoni? If a beinoni was half sinful, he would know if he was half sinful. It's something that you can clearly see, that he spends a lot of time sinning, or at least half of his time that he acts, half of it is full of sins. Okay? It's something that he can clearly recognize. He made such a big mistake. V'naida de la pasuk poim begirsa ad she'afilu malach ha'maves le'hayayachal lishleit bai. When it is known that his mouth never ceased studying the Torah, so much so that even the angel of death had no dominion over him. Such was Rabba's diligence, and this is in quantity, that he didn't neglect his studies for even one moment. So when did he have time to sin? His mouth never stopped studying. Qualitatively, too, his learning was on such a high level that the angel of death was unable to overpower him. So Rabba is the head of the yeshiva of Pumbedisa, and he had something going on, which we still have today, called Yarchei Kala. Yarchei Kala was 2 months in the year where people packed their bags and went to yeshiva. Tishrei and Nisan. It was low agricultural season and they can take off from work and they can come back to learn, keep their Torah knowledge fresh. So somebody complained about Rabbah because the tax collectors would come every month to collect taxes, but 2 months of the year, the homeowners weren't home. So they felt like they were evading taxes. And they said, there is one man who takes 12,000 people twice a year for 2 months of the year, and they are not paying taxes. So they went after Rabbah. So Rabbah ran away. He ran from Pumbedisa, where he was, to Akma, from Akma to Agra, and from Agra, I can't remember all the different places he went, to Ein Adamya finally, and then he comes back to Pumbedisa. And when he comes back to Pumbedisa, his original point, he is in the same inn as the guy who is running after him. Now, the guy who was running after him doesn't know that it's Rabbah, but what happened was the waiters brought this guy 2 glasses of wine on a tray. And he drank the 2 glasses of wine, and his face turned backward. Because in the times of the Gemara, there were demons that were provoked by pears. So if things came in pairs, and people speak about it even today, zugeis, there's such a concept of zugeis, things coming in pairs. If things came in pairs, it would arouse their ire, and they would do something. So this guy who drank wine in pairs, his face was now backwards. So the attendants at the inn were very nervous. They said, this is a man of the government. We're going to be in very big trouble. They're going to blame it on us. What should we do? So Rabbah was a guest there. And he said, you know what? Come back with a tray of just 1 glass. Have him drink the 1 glass. Take the tray away and he's going to be fine. So that's what they did. And his face turned the right way again. And suddenly the man realized, he said, oh, this is the man that I seek. And he said, you know what? I'm going to leave this place. If they're going to kill me, they'll kill me. But if they torture me, I'm just going to have to say where you are. And the innkeeper locked Rabbah up in a room, and Rabbah prayed, and the wall crumbled from the other side, and he ran away into the forest. Now, he's in the forest, and in the meantime, there's an argument going on in heaven. They're talking about a certain kind of tzara'as. If a person is in a certain situation, there's something called a baharas, where there's a shiny spot on the skin. So they have this shiny spot on the skin. They go to the Kohen, and the Kohen says, okay, you're in quarantine for 7 days. After 7 days, they come back to the Kohen, and the Kohen looks, is there a white hair? Did the hair in this baharas turn white? If it turned white, then he is tummy. If the hair was there first, and then the spot came, then he's pure. So now there's an argument. What happens if we are not sure what came first, the spot or the hair? So Hashem says that he's pure. If it's a doubtful situation, he's pure. And Yeshiva Shalmaila, the Heavenly Academy, is arguing with Hashem. And they say impure. So they have to decide. How do they decide? They have to decide by somebody down here on earth, because the Torah lo b'shamayim he. Hashem gave the Torah to us, and a human being, a Jewish person on planet Earth, living a physical life, that is the one to decide. Who's going to decide? So they said, let's get Rabbah Bar Nachmani. He's the one who said, Ani Yachid B'Negaim, Ani Yachid Ba'alais. I'm singular in my knowledge of Tzara'as afflictions, and I'm singular in my knowledge of dead people in a tent. So Rabbah sees this vision while he's running away. And they're asking him, is it pure or is it not pure? Now the angel of death is trying to get his soul, but he can't because Rabbah is nonstop learning. And so he starts to make a lot of noise and he thinks, oh my gosh, the Romans are chasing me. They found me in the forest. So he said he'd rather die than be caught by the Romans. So he stops for a second. And when he's distracted, the angel of death came to take his soul. And while he's still in a body, he says, Tahor, Tahor, it is pure, it is pure. And a voice from heaven said, how fortunate are you, Rabbah Bar Nachmani, that your body was pure and your soul left in purity. So this is Rabbah Bar Nachmani. He says, I am singular in my knowledge of Tzara'as affliction. I am singular. That's what he says about himself. And yet, when trying to figure out what is a Beinoni, and his students can't figure it out, he says, you want an example? I am a Beinoni. He's not lying. He made a mistake. But how did he come to make such a mistake? How then could he err in considering that half his deeds were sinful, God forbid? Okay, so we're asking, how could Rabbah have sinned with half sins, God forbid? So we have to say that there's something about the level of the Beinoni that's not, It's not about action. It's something much deeper. It has to be something in the depths of the soul that an outside observer cannot see, but the person in themselves may know that they have this. To the outside, this person may seem to be exactly like a tzaddik, but in a very deep inner space, there's a difference between the Beinoni and the tzaddik. Okay, now let's get practical. Let's say, we're going to say that a Beinoni is half sinful, okay? Practically, when could somebody ever be called a Beinoni? Let's look at it. V'ayid, shaharei b'sha'a sha'aysa avayneis nikkur rasha gamor. Furthermore, when can a person be considered a Beinoni? For at the time that one sins, until he does teshuva, until he repents, he's deemed completely wicked. Okay, so he can't be half sins, because when he's sinning, he's completely wicked. V'im achar kach asa teshuva, nikkur tzadik gamor. And if he was sinful and then repented, thus ceasing to be sinful, ceasing to be wicked, he is deemed completely righteous. You could say, okay, he can't be someone who is sinning because that's a rasha gamor. But maybe he's someone who sinned and then did teshuva. No, but as soon as he does teshuva, he's called completely righteous. The Talmud has a very interesting scenario. Okay, so there's a guy who betroths a woman on a condition. Now, if somebody betroths a woman or makes any transaction on a false premise, the transaction is void. So he's marrying this woman on a condition that he is completely righteous. Great. She's so happy to be married to a tzaddik. She gets married and she finds out not only is he not completely righteous, but actually he's a crook. Okay, so she wants a seit. She doesn't even need a get. She just wants to walk away. Does she need a get? The Talmud says that she needs a get out of the doubt that maybe at the time he said to her, I marry you on the condition that I'm perfectly righteous. Shema, hear her, tshuva b'daitai. At that moment, he had thoughts of teshuva in his mind. And because he had thoughts of teshuva in his mind, he went from being completely wicked to completely righteous. So when, isn't that amazing, by the way? Like, it's so hard to do teshuva, but it's also just so simple to do teshuva. It's just a thought away of like, Hashem, I'm yours. I never want to disappoint you again. I want to be a tzaddik. That's it. Simple as that. So when is somebody ever a Beinoni? If he's sinning, he's a Rasha. If he did teshuva, he's righteous. And this is going to be a big struggle that we're going to come across as we're going to look at the Tanya, because, and I have to be very frank, you know, sometimes my kids have come home from school and said, Mommy, my teacher said that according to the Tanya, we're a Rasha. And, you know, you have to wonder, it's not the teacher that's making this up. It's because if you look at the Tanya, you're going to walk away and think, okay, the standard is this high to be a Beinoni, so everybody else must be a Rasha. But clearly, at the beginning of the Tanya, the Alter Rebbe warned and said, you cannot consider yourself a Rasha. This is so dangerous. If you consider yourself a Rasha, either you're going to be depressed or you're going to be spiritually negligent. So to walk around and say, well, I'm a Rasha, that clearly is not the way. Now, Tzvi Friedman, like I told many of you at class, is writing a new translation of the Tanya. And it's not yet published, but he's kind enough to share with me the upcoming chapters. And he gives a treatment of this idea of, no one wants to walk away thinking I'm a Rasha. So what do you do? Now, he told me also about his dialogue with some experts who disagree with him and based on sound sources, but it's just unthinkable. The Alter Rebbe says it very clearly that you can't walk around thinking of yourself as a Rasha. It's okay to be remorseful, not okay. We definitely have to be remorseful when we did the wrong thing. If we did the wrong thing, we have to feel contrite. Why would we feel contrite? To get us to change our ways. But if nothing I'm going to do is ever going to help, and I'm just a Rasha because the standard is impossible, you just give up. You know, people are motivated to a certain point. As soon as there is an impossible hurdle, you're just not going to. You say, you know, climb till here. Okay, I can try that. Climb till here. Okay, I can try that. Okay, climb Mount Everest today, and you've never been trained. It's like, are you joking? Like, it's not even something that's going to enter your mind. So if the standard is that high, and the Tanya is telling you that you shouldn't consider yourself a Rasha, we have to remember that the Alter Rebbe is talking to every ordinary person. That's what he said in chapter 14. He said, Midas ha-Beinonihi, Midas kol Adam, v'achareha kol Adam yimsheich. The Midah of the Beinoni is every person. It's within the reach of every person. Everybody has to aspire for it. So each of us really could be a Beinoni. We should not walk around thinking of ourselves as a Rasha. And one of the things that Zvi Friedman said is two things. First of all, he said, okay, so let's say someone finds chametz in their home on Pesach. You're not allowed to have chametz in your home on Pesach. From the time that you find the chametz till the time that you burn the chametz, are you considered sinful? And the Alter Rebbe addresses this in his Shulchan Aruch, and he says, no. From the moment you decide you're burning it until you actually get it done, because you have to get your stuff together or whatever, you're not considered negligent at that time. So yes, we're not there yet. We're all trying, but we're bent on reaching that space. So we're in the middle of running after the chametz. So we're not considered a rush at that time. We're working towards Beinoni. There's different levels of Beinoni. There's the Beinoni, like an essential being of a Beinoni, or there's a Beinoni as this moment right now, I'm a Beinoni. That's all within our reach. And the other thing he says is sincerely not wanting to be a Rasha, which we don't, that is teshuva. And what does the Alter Rebbe say? The second you do teshuva, you're a tzaddik, which the Beinoni is a tzaddik, as we're going to see, on a behavioral level. So we should never walk away and think of ourselves, well, I looked at the Tanya, I read it through, I'm a Rasha. God forbid. That's exactly what the Alter Rebbe warned us against. Don't consider yourself a Rasha. This was what the Mishnah says. And besides, just from common sense, you can't consider yourself a Rasha. So let's summarize what we said in class until now today. And we talked about the oath that we took before coming down here. That we are made to swear. First of all, be a tzaddik. Second of all, don't be a Rasha. And third of all, even if the whole world tells you that you are a tzaddik, you should consider yourself a Rasha. Now, we have to understand, you can't consider yourself a Rasha because the Mishnah says, don't be a Rasha in your own eyes. And furthermore, if you're going to think of yourself as a Rasha, you're going to be depressed, so you won't be able to serve Hashem with joy. And if you're not going to be depressed, then you'll become apathetic because you'll say, well, I don't care. And that's very dangerous because you'll be spiritually negligent. So how are we supposed to understand this? The Alter Rebbe now tells us, let's look at it in a broader scale. There are five categories among the Jewish people. There's the complete tzaddik and the incomplete tzaddik. There's the complete Rasha and the incomplete Rasha and the Beinoni. So the Gemara explains that tzaddik v'tevli, a tzaddik who prospers is a complete tzaddik. A tzaddik v'ralai, a tzaddik who suffers is an incomplete tzaddik. And the Zohar explains tzaddik v'ralo, a tzaddik that evil is to him, means that the evil that is within him is subjugated to the good that's within him. Now in the Talmud, it tells us more about the tzaddik and the Rasha. And what does it say? It says that a tzaddik, the yetzer tov, the good inclination is who rules him. The Rasha, the wicked person, the yetzer hara, the evil inclination is who rules him. And who is a Beinoni? A Beinoni is someone who's ruled by both the yetzer tov and the yetzer hara. So we have to understand all of this because Eev is complaining to Hashem and he said, Master of the world, you created tzaddikim. They're tzaddikim because you created them that way. You created Rasha'im. They're wicked because you created that way. But one second. Didn't we learn that Hashem doesn't decree who's going to be righteous and who's going to be wicked? So we really have to understand the Beinoni because for sure he's not half and half. Rabba gave an example of a Beinoni and he said, for example, I am a Beinoni. But we know that he never stopped learning Torah to the point that even the angel of death was not able to conquer him. So it must be a very elusive category that Rabba was able to mistakenly, even though he was a tzaddik, consider himself a Rasha. Now we have to understand, when can somebody ever be considered a Beinoni? If they're sinning at that moment, they're a Rasha. If they did teshuva at that moment, they're a tzaddik. So where is that space where they are a Beinoni? And we're going to look at more examples of maybe a Beinoni is this and maybe a Beinoni is that. And we're going to see that a Beinoni is not any of that. A Beinoni must be something that we never even realize.